Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. Disrespect would like to welcome Peter Clutterbuck of the Social Planning Network of Ontario, a partner in the 25 and 5 Strategy for Poverty Reduction. Peter, welcome to the show.
A pleasure to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about the latest initiative to put food in the budget? It sounds very timely. It's the kind of thing that in the past agencies have sort of sat back and said, well, we've done the advocacy, let's wait and see if it shows up in the legislation. But this time it looks like you're leaning on the government right up until the introduction of the budget on the 26th.
Yeah. Well, I think everyone recognizes that provincial and federal budgets nowadays can change even right up to the last minute, given the nature of the times we're in and the strength of the case that you can make for including certain things in the budget. So even though many people assume it's all gone to bed and we're just going to hear it on March 2026, we're pretty sure that if people across the province make a strong case for increasing the benefits to people on social assistance to allow them to eat more healthy and adequate diets, that that the Ontario people will support that, and the Minister of Finance will hear it, and maybe we could get $100 a month healthy food supplement into this budget for people on social assistance.
How old's the Healthy Food Supplement Initiative, and where did it start?
Well, actually, it started when the 25 and 5 Network for Poverty Reduction sent me and a colleague, Marvin Novak, on the road in November and December with what was called the Blueprint for Poverty Reduction, where we talked to people in 26 communities across the province, met more than 1,000 people in community meetings. And one of the issues that came up and one of the proposals that we made was that the fact that social assistance rates had not increased since 1995. That single adults on social assistance are making, are receiving $580 a month. The inflation rate has increased by more than 27% since 1999 in terms of the cost of food. And there's a recognition that people were really going through chronic cycles of hunger every month, having to rely on food banks more and other people in the community and charity, and that they just weren't able to provide adequately for themselves. So the idea emerged that was tested in these communities of starting to move towards adequacy in social assistance rates with a $100 a month healthy food supplement that we see.
And you say this was
quite
tested?
A positive response from people out there.
Oh, the idea they were the idea was put out for criticism, was it?
It was put out to test whether people thought it was a viable way to start to look at adequacy for people in social assistance, and received overwhelmingly positive response.
Good. And where was it tested? Do you recall?
Oh, God, we were from Thunder Bay to Niagara Region, from Cornwall to Windsor, and all points in between, 26 communities in a three-and-a-half-week period. These would be like 2 or 3 hour meetings on in the evenings or in the afternoons with people from community services, faith people, people from kind of the public health field, everyday citizens, people who are interested in doing something about poverty in this province.
Yeah, I spoke to the Salvation Army recently, and their hot meal program, the attendance is up 30% this year. And I asked them, I said, well, what if it goes up 50% from here? What do you, you know, how do you propose to meet that demand? Because, I mean, you have a limited size dining room, and you have a fixed plant for the kitchen, and undoubtedly you have some kind of limit on funding. What do you do? And the answer that I got back with all confidence was that God will provide. And I thought that was an admirable commitment from the Salvation Army, but it doesn't really take into account the limits that any agency faces in trying to meet these demands. The the $100 a month. How do we arrive at that figure?
Well, actually, it's just a start. It's not. It doesn't really recover the same level of support that people received in the mid-1990s. In fact, it's about a third. They've lost about a third of their purchasing power in terms of being able to buy food every month since 1993. They've lost about $300, and we're only trying to get we're getting $100 back. So we're actually regaining a third of what they should be getting in order to eat at the same level as they did in the 1990s. And so basically we don't see this as the final, you know, way to go, but as a start towards adequacy that maybe over the next number of years we can get people more adequate incomes and do more to help them get off social assistance and into employment. One of the things we found is people eating with inadequate incomes essentially become unhealthy, become sick, are not able to get into the workforce or to go back to school as easily as if they remain healthy and active.
So they're cut off at the knees, in effect, by the income.
Yeah, it kind of undermines their ability to be part of the community. No one really wants to live on social assistance for a very long period of time. People, every time there's a chance for people to get off in terms of training programs, they're always oversubscribed. But it is it becomes worse if you become unhealthy and ill while you're on social assistance in terms of actually getting out of it.
Yeah. I keep turning to the political parameters of this, and it's a little early in the interview to go there, but I can't help but think that Dalton McGuinty was elected by a right-wing contingent of the Liberal Party as a fresh face, which he was. He had very little campaign experience and certainly very little policy experience from what I recall of meeting him. And he's moving his party and his support towards the center by even entertaining these things. Remember, he captured a proportion of the 905 Harris vote to get elected. And now he's persuading them that these nasty people on welfare are really more deserving than we've given them credit for. Do you have any idea how he plans to pull this off? Is this really something that could happen?
Well, he hasn't made a specific commitment to the Northern Finance Ministry to the $100 a month healthy supplement yet. That's what we're trying to convince him to do. He has responded to the community's kind of pressure for a poverty reduction strategy by starting with a 25% reduction in 5 years for child and family poverty. So we give him credit for having taken that initiative. We do point out that really we need to deal with adult poverty as well, and that even kids and families have parents who require adequate incomes in order to support their families well. So we haven't convinced the premier or the finance minister yet. We're hoping that when we have medical officers of health across the province pointing out that the government expects them to actually measure what the nutritious food basket is every year for the last 10 years, and it points out how far people's incomes fall below the nutritious food basket, that if they're asking for this data, they should be planning to do some policy response to close that gap. We're hoping that kind of message to the Premier and the Finance Minister will be convincing.
Do the medical officers of health, or have they offered to provide the information to help determine what the budget for food should be? Or is this a separate initiative that requires a new political vetting and a long period of setup and administration?
Yeah. Well, actually, the food supplement that we're promoting could just be added to the existing basic needs allowance that the government already issues every month, a check to people on social assistance. We're just asking that same mechanism be used to increase that amount by $100 a month for adults. The medical officers of health have actually just last Thursday released kind of their endorsement of this food campaign, as well as all the research they have showing, you know, with the cost of a nutritious food basket in 36 communities across this province, and how people on social assistance really cannot adequately afford to eat in a healthy way when you look at what this data actually shows. And so the Association of Local Public Health Agencies, which is made up of the medical officers of health, have now come out formally and officially endorsing this campaign. And actually, some of them are now starting to have their own campaigns in their local communities to make media announcements and to promote the $100 a month with their local MPPs. There'll be an example like that this week in Cornwall, for example, next week in Belleville and Kingston, places like that.
So measuring the food basket is something that would come later. The $100 is designed to get the people on fixed incomes out of a spot that they're in right now.
Get them on the road, yeah. The actual, and one of the things that the medical officers of health are pointing out is that even the nutritious food basket is a pretty minimal basic necessities. That we need to have a more thorough and complete research done on what it actually costs to meet your basic necessities of monthly living, and including food and including rent and other necessities people have around managing a household, and that should be part of the social assistance review that the province is saying it will launch in the spring. In a way, they're pointing to what the data shows already about the shortfalls, but the fact is that we also have to be a bit more thorough in our research around setting social assistance rates in the future.
Yeah, it's kind of silly on an income that's below the poverty line to try and separate food from rent, from other expenses, as if everybody put the money into envelopes, and then when they ran out of food money, they just stopped eating. Or if they put food first, they ran out of rent money, they just went to the landlord and said, oh, well, too bad this month, you know, better luck next month.
Yeah.
This kind of income, that kind of planning doesn't...
We are asking.
It probably organizes things, but it probably falls apart at the end of the month.
Yeah. We find that we're actually at one part of this campaign is 100 words on $100. We're asking low-income people on social assistance, what difference $100 a month would make in terms of their ability to budget and eat healthily. And so they're writing their 100 words and sometimes more, and we're posting them on our website. And we're also trying to take little video clips of people when you travel around the province, people who are willing to kind of speak what difference $100 would make in their diet. And we actually listen to people. They're pretty consistently recognizing that they eat mostly starchy foods and poor quality food and canned food, and they get very little fruit and vegetables, fresh fruit and vegetables. People are pretty conscious of what it takes to be healthy, and they just say they don't have the means to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, especially in places like Toronto where you can't offset that with a lower rent or lesser accommodations. Even the cheapest accommodations are too expensive to allow for, you know, healthy eating.
That's right. A single adult in Toronto, but on social assistance, $580 a month. When you look at the very minimal basic necessities package of rent and food is $360 or so behind every single month. So obviously that person is relying on other means and sources like food banks and friends or charities and churches to even get by, or frankly, quite frequently during the course of that month being hungry.
Yeah. How does that affect people with disabilities in your research or your asking for comments?
Well, the people with disabilities did not experience the same level of cuts as people in Ontario Works in 1995, but their rates were frozen, so they're getting more money on a monthly basis, but still people in disabilities have extraordinary costs that many of us don't have, such as even getting around their community transportation, for example.
Yeah.
They also have a lot more difficulty getting access to the workforce, in other words, getting off of ODSP into employment, so they have more chronic kind of higher duration type of periods on ODSP. So although they weren't as severely cut in the mid-1990s as people in Ontario Works, they do have extraordinary living costs, and they are spending almost all of their money on either rent or food and have very little left over for other important necessities of life.
Yeah. It's not a pretty picture. You've been listening to Peter Clutterbuck of the Social Planning Network of Ontario and a partner in the 25 and 5 anti-poverty strategy talk about put food in the budget. And now let's take a break. Halfway through the interview, M&S Boogie, Memphis Slim, and Roosevelt Sykes. What do you hope for if McGuinty comes back and says, well, you know, he's not said it yet, but, well, you know, we've got a $13 billion deficit. I thought it would be $500 million, but it's not.
Yeah.
And this is just not the right time. But we will study it, which he's done with so many other things.
Yeah. Well, I think that most governments realize now, given the economic circumstances we have, that study is no longer in vogue. That, in fact, I think they do recognize they have to act. They've accepted the need to go into deficit in order to kind of re-stimulate economies. Mm-hmm. We're actually promoting the food supplement, which costs about $473 million a year.
$473 million. Three. Okay.
Yeah. That's part of a larger $2.5 billion package for poverty reduction that we're actually promoting with the finance minister and the premier, including other important things in the areas of affordable housing, for example, Ontario child support and things like child benefit. And we're saying that this $2.4 billion should be part of the $14 billion package, because one of the things we know about things like putting money into the pockets of people who are the poorest is that they spend it in their local economies, they don't save it, and they don't go on vacations with it. So they can be one of the ways that we can get an economic stimulus going at our local economy level. Even the International Monetary Fund has recommended, if you want to have quick and fast economic recovery at the community level, you get money into the pockets of the lowest income people because they spend it.
Oh, the International Monetary Fund has come up with that. That's unusual for them, isn't it?
Well, you know, we don't often cite the International Monetary Fund in our field. But last November at the summit that was held in Washington, the managing director, Mr. Cohn, he actually was asked the question, you know, how do we get quick economic recovery given the worsening recession and moving towards a depression? He said the fastest way to do it, most efficient way to do it, is to increase your social infrastructure by getting money into the pockets of the lowest income people because they spend it locally, and strengthening your social safety net like affordable housing and things like that. So he was quite explicit about that in November last year.
Mm. This doesn't do anything for the car business, of course, because the lowest income people
don't buy cars.
Well,
you know, that $14 billion package overall, as well as the federal contribution, there's lots of room there for other important industrial sectors to get assistance. We're just saying it's smart economics to include poverty reduction as part of your economic stimulus package.
One arrow in the quiver.
Yeah, that's right.
Very good. What kind of response have you received from the government? You've said that McGuinty has been cautiously accepting of the idea?
Well, no, I don't think, I think that they're here. There's evidence that they are getting this message from, when medical officers of health start to hold press conferences, media conferences, and urge this kind of thing, we know that they are respected public officials, and that local MPPs and cabinet ministers do take note when they are all on side on something. So we know that they're hearing the message. They haven't given us any sign how they're responding yet. We just see it as our job to mobilize more support about this and to help give them some confidence about acting boldly in this way. This is actually one very clear way where the minister, where the premier could take bold action to not only meet a social need but also contribute to economic recovery.
So you think the voter sentiment is at least changing? If you can't track the politician's response yet, you think the voters are at least changing their tack on mean, thieving, dishonest, yeah, parasitic welfare recipients?
I've been. That's interesting because I have been. I was on a cable TV program last week where I expected to hear nothing but that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The first seven people who phoned in were quite supportive of it. They weren't on social assistance themselves, but they thought it was a good idea. They understood the health issue. They understood the problem, right, of people living in these hard economic times with inadequate money. And then near the end, we had a couple of people who held the traditional views. But I was really quite surprised because ordinarily this particular program is maybe known for generating some of that kind of thing. And I do think when I look at news reports at some of the people who post their comments and responses that they are a lot more balanced than they used to be around this kind of thing. And we're getting interesting postings on our website as well showing some awareness. So I think maybe Ontario citizens, everybody's kind of looking at their own economic situation, and they are more sensitive to what the cost of living is in terms of food themselves. And maybe they do recognize people trying to live on $580 a month are hardly going to be able to pay the rent and buy adequate food if they themselves are starting to pay more attention to the cost of food.
Yeah, at $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, they're having trouble, yeah. I did download information from the web on the rise in the cost of food. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I didn't bring it with me, but one of the things that struck me was the rise in the cost of fresh fruit and the rise in the cost of grain over the last year with the increase in commodity prices. Now, commodity prices have fallen, and I think the price of a loaf of bread has probably stabilized. I don't know whether it's fallen at this point in time, but the rise in prices was like 20%, pretty close to 17, 19%. Do you are you aware of other areas where this has happened?
In Ontario?
Well, other areas of the food budget.
Yeah, not. I know that the Heart and Stroke Foundation put out a good piece of research about a week and a half ago, showing the increase and that there is variability across different communities in Canada, in Ontario. For example, if you want to kind of have the best prices, I guess you should live in Peterborough.
Oh, really?
But I do think the Medical Officer of Health pointed out that since 1999, the cost of nutritious food basket has increased by 27%. So that
the inflation factor
for just healthy food would be about 27%. He pointed out in the last 10 years.
Yeah, and but shockingly, you know, double digit increases in the last year.
Yeah, that is shocking, and you can imagine how difficult it is for people who, you know, who are on the lowest end of the income level trying to do anything about that.
One of the things about being at the low end of the income level is that most of your income probably goes for fixed expenses, for things that you cannot do without, and as a result, they have a fixed cost, like rent, for instance.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, that's frankly, that is why we have food banks now, because people, you know, over the last 30 years, when people do, if they have a choice between being on the streets or eating, they want shelter at least, and then try to figure out how to survive in terms of, you know, eating. Otherwise, especially if they have kids, they have to have a stable place to live. So they're more inclined to put their money into rent and try to... try to economize with what's left over, or use food banks, or churches, or friends for food, and frankly, have fewer meals, not eat as often during the week.
Really?
We've had parents talk about getting towards the end of the month, when before the check comes in, where they stay hungry and they make sure their kids eat.
Yeah.
Which results in parents getting ill and not being able to parent well if they're not healthy. We've had stories like that.
Any comments from our old friends with regard to food allowances, Sandra Pupatello, or even Madeleine Meilleur?
Actually, Madame Meilleur has not kind of weighed in on this as far as we can see. We would like to have, when we take this campaign into local communities, if they have a member of provincial parliament who's a cabinet minister, we think that's an added advantage to be able to represent this issue and the other part of the 25 and 5 package to them. We do hope that all MPPs and cabinet ministers get the message that we're trying to deliver to the Minister of Finance and the Premier, because they are the key people right now who are going to decide what's presented on March 26th. And this campaign, you know, will continue beyond that if we don't get what's really necessary, because we just can't let this kind of hunger and health issue continue.
Yeah. Have you been inviting cabinet ministers specifically to these community events around food?
Well, actually, when we did this whole series of consultations last year, they were invited during the consultation of the Poverty Reduction Strategy. We encouraged them. And
I recall that, and you were quite successful.
Yeah, they vote 44 came to 50 meetings. And some of them came to the blueprint meetings we had in the fall, and we would be really thrilled if they would actually come out to meetings that are already scheduled. But I think even if they don't come to the meetings where low-income people and medical officers of health are coming together, we're hoping that they will receive visits from people who are at these meetings to hear them make the case for it.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Have you conducted a meeting in Windsor?
Actually, I'm at 3 o'clock this afternoon. I'm talking to our Windsor contact about what they might be interested in doing. One of the most active groups out in Windsor is the Community Legal Clinic. They've been very active in doing the consultations, and they have had an ongoing kind of relationship with the finance minister. He's their local MPP. So we will be talking to the Windsor people about their interest in being involved in this campaign this very afternoon.
I bring up Windsor, of course, because that's Sandra Pupatello's riding.
That's where she is as well.
And she...
I knew the finance minister was out there, the treasurer was out there, but I didn't remember that.
But she... She was outraged when people tried to access the special diet allowance because they couldn't get enough to eat and sought to punish them for it.
Yeah, and that's one thing that's important. The Medical Officers of Health, Dave McEwen here in Toronto, was very clear that this particular healthy food supplement idea is not going to interfere with the special diet allowance, which on average I think people get about $250 more a month because they have special medical conditions that require them to have certain foods.
That's actually the maximum, and the government's attacked that pretty severely by reviewing it to bring the totals down.
So
I would imagine the average is probably under $100.
Under $100 now. Well, there is an issue about this should be complete, separate, and distinct from the healthy food supplement. If people have medical conditions as well that require certain dietary requirements, and they also get reviewed or assessed for this medically, that should stay in place, and the food supplement should be in addition to that.
So when you're done, you figure you have another $200 to go to get the income back, even up to what it was in 1993, something like that?
For a single adult, that would be the case. And we're arguing... This is part of the overall package of the 25 and 5 network, which is basic living conditions have to be central to any poverty reduction strategy, and one of those is having adequate incomes for people on social assistance and helping them get off social assistance into employment. And the issue of adequacy means that we got to start somewhere, and it doesn't mean that people stay on social assistance forever at higher income levels. It means starting to reduce the difference between the poverty line and what people are able to live on in social assistance, and then helping them get off it as quickly as possible.
All right. Was there anything else that you in particular wanted to say about this initiative that we haven't addressed so far?
Well, I think that we're really interested in the public's interest in supporting kind of people on social assistance to be able to get this food supplement, and if people really do think that that this recession really is pointing out how difficult it is to live even on the middle income levels or median income levels. Imagine how hard it is for people at the lowest income levels, and perhaps support the healthy food supplement in letters to their MPPs or conversations with them or emails. That would be what we would ask people to do.
Okay. And you mentioned your website, but we didn't take down the address for people who are listening and within a grabbing range of a pencil or a pen.
Sure.
Perhaps you could give us that web address.
Okay. You can find our Put Food in the Budget link on the website of www.25in5numerals.ca. So 25 number in 5number.ca, and when you go to that website, you'll see Put Food in the Budget. You click on that, and you'll go to things like testimonials people have given about their 100 words for $100 on $100, and little video clips on people telling their stories, and a petition that I think we're just putting up today so that people can actually vote in support of this campaign.
Okay, so that link is not only for people who are on fixed incomes, but it's also to a petition that anybody can sign.
Yeah, petition. We hope anybody would take an interest and sign and help us encourage the finance minister and premier to take bold action on poverty reduction, of which this Put Food in the Budget would be one clear element.
Yeah, from what you say, even the IMF agrees with you for once.
Yeah, that's right. We'll milk that one for as long as we can.
Well, Peter, I appreciate your time spent with me today to discuss this subject.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for taking the time with us.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Peter Clutterbuck on Put Food in the Budget, something we hope will happen on March the 26th when Dalton McGuinty's budget comes down. Now for a break with Memphis Slim and Roosevelt Sykes, Help Me Some.
know you've got to be the maid. So when every Saturday comes, we both can get paid. So you can help me some.
Something a little bit different today from the album of the same name, Muta Baruka, and dub poetry set to music, a little reminiscent of, well, you tell me, called The Confusion Today, Wagwan.
The confusion today, I say, confusion today, I say, must be led away, must be led away. By our need to be fair and just, by our need to be fair and just. Not for some, but for all of us, not for some, but for all of us. To counter the need for greed, to starve the hatred we feed. History will teach us nothing, if all life can end by the press of a button. So now we have to check what must be saved and what we wreck. To see the good in things, we have to see ourselves in things. No peace, no peace, until there's equal rights and justice. So now we have to check what must be saved and what we wreck. To see the good in things, we have to see ourselves in things. No peace, no peace, until there's equal rights and justice. Many have heard this before. Many still fight for what they are not sure. No peace, no peace, we shout. Liberty and freedom, that's what it is all about. So we turn to the leaders of the state. All we find is more and more hate. No solution for our problems at hand. Everyone must take a stand. So here we are still, so here we are still. Trying to find the will, trying to find the will. To fight a lie that has been told,
to fight a lie that has been told.
A truth they stole,
a truth they stole.
A heart gotten cold,
a heart gotten cold.
If what is to be, then we will have to make it be. If what we seek is to be free, then all will have to be free. If one is free, and the others are not free, then no man can truly say he's free. Because the freedom of one is dependent on the freedom of all. And if they all should fall, then the one cannot stand. If what is to be, then we will have to make it be. If what we seek is to be free, then all will have to be free. If one is free and the others are not free, then no man can truly say he's free. Because the freedom of one is dependent on the freedom of all. And if the all should fall, then the one cannot stand. The cry of the poor is getting louder for sure. Chances must be taken. The dreamer must be awakened. Awake from the illusion. Face the confusion. The cry of the poor is getting louder for sure. Chances must be taken. The dreamer must be awakened. Awake from the illusion. Face the confusion. Freedom starts in the mind. Now is the time. Open the door. Freedom is the cure. The sun will shine bright again. Joy comes sometimes with pain. Take a stand. Make a plan. Freedom can come from the power of one. Powerful people will never educate powerless people in what it means to take the power away from them. The aim of powerful people is to stay powerful by any means necessary. John Henry Clark.
And now for Disrespect's news review. First in the Star. Stuart Laidlaw, faith and ethics reporter. Faithful unite to help the poor. There's a tale from the current economic downturn that will stay with Kathy Stone the rest of her life, a tale of a bag of potatoes and six hungry children. We got the call that there was no food, says Stone, executive director of the Rural Outreach Center at St. Matthew's St. Aidan Anglican Church in Buckhorn, north of Peterborough. She grabbed what food there was at the center for victims of family violence and the disadvantaged and brought it to the single mother and her children. Honestly, the kids were jumping for joy over a bag of potatoes, says Stone, a deacon with her church. I thought in my heart that this is just like a third world country. What kids get excited about food? The religious groups have vowed to hold prayer vigils at Queen's Park until the budget is delivered. The Monday to Thursday vigil will feature a different faith leader directing prayers morning and afternoon. Several faiths, including Christian, Muslim, Jewish, and Hindu, will be represented, and churches across Ontario organizing buses to bring the faithful to Toronto to pray. Many of those coming down will be from Anglican churches, where Toronto Bishop Colin Johnson has made poverty alleviation a major focus of his diocese. Up in Buckhorn, Stone says she has seen firsthand the devastating effect the downturn has had on those already in need and will be looking to the budget for help. There are some very poor people, says Stone. They don't deserve to be overlooked. They deserve to be treated with respect. I hope we didn't tell you this story last week. A German research has shown a link between changes in the weather and a variety of health conditions. Website Weather Alert gives heads up on your health. The founders of a new Canadian website are hoping millions of subscribers throughout the world will sign up to receive weather-based health alerts. The site sends emails to people who suffer from a variety of conditions, asthma, arthritis, diabetes, heart disease, and migraines, 24 hours before a change in the weather is expected to make their symptoms worse, potentially saving them from a trip to an already crowded emergency room. To be forewarned is to be forearmed, says John Bart, a Toronto doctor, and Mediclim.com. Co-founder. That's Mediclim, M-E-D-I-C-L-I-M.com.
About 1,000 people in Canada, the U.S., and Britain and Ireland have signed up since Mediclim launched in December. There are plans to expand into France in the near future with the rest of Europe, Australia, and Japan to follow. Ian Bailey, Vancouver. Canada withholding information on Sikansky case, Poland says. Although Polish prosecutors have launched an investigation into the case, the effort was sparked because of Mr. Sikansky's Polish citizenry and is not aimed at making a case against the officers. Sylwia Domizowicz, the embassy's press and protocol officer, said in an interview. Sikansky died on October 14, 2007, after his behavior at the International Arrivals Area of Vancouver Airport prompted a call to police. The four Mounties who responded tasered and tackled him. Captured on a bystander's video that was seen around the world, the incident has fueled debate on the police use of stun guns. Under the terms of the Bilateral Treaty on Mutual Legal Assistance in Criminal Matters, which dates from the mid-90s, Canada is supposed to share information with Poland. However, there's some confusion about the state of the agreement. Ms. Domizowicz said Canada has suspended cooperation under the treaty, denying Poland access to material from the inquiry. Ms. Domizowicz suggested BC's Ministry of the Attorney General has not been cooperating in providing information of interest to Poland, but a ministry spokesman said he was not aware of those concerns. The Star, Petty Fong, Western Canada Bureau Chief. Defiance marks Mountie's testimony in taser probe. The officers who have testified at the Braidwood inquiry into Sikansky's death, Jerry Rundle and Bill Bentley, have expressed regret, but generally under cross-examination by lawyers representing Sikansky's family or the Polish government. That left the tough questions to lawyers Walter Kostecki and representing Sikansky's mother, Zofia Szczesowski, and Don Rosenblum representing Poland. It was Kostecki, a former RCMP officer, who questioned how Rundell could misinterpret the gesture of Sikansky with his two hands raised, palms facing forward, and fingers pointed upwards as anything but the universally recognized sign of surrender. My interpretation of what he was saying, to hell with you guys, I'm out of here, said Rundell in his testimony. His behavior then became resistant when he left. The video, Rosenblum maintains, shows clearly that Sikansky was not being aggressive but was doing exactly what the RCMP commanded him to do when the taser was used without warning. The taser was used 5 times. In notes made directly after the incident, Bentley wrote that Sikansky came at the officers screaming and waving a stapler. Bentley now acknowledges those notes were incorrect. When the Mounties were first taking the stand, Sergeant Tim Shields, spokesman for the BC Division, said he was pleased the truth would finally emerge. What emerged was a pair of officers saying there was no time to evaluate the situation and the only remedy they had was to perceive an unarmed man as a threat to themselves and the public within 30 seconds of the encounter. Both remained adamant they had no choice and their training required them to do what they did. And from the Globe and Mail, the Canadian Press, mentally disabled girl tasered, lawsuit says. The father of a 14-year-old girl from northwestern Ontario is suing the Ontario Provincial Police after his daughter was shocked with a taser. A statement of claim alleges two officers used the device on the girl after she was told to stop scratching at the paint inside a jail cell in Sioux Lookout, Ontario. The lawsuit, filed January 23rd in Ontario Superior Court in Kenora, says the officers entered the cell without warning, violently pulled the girl to the ground, and applied the taser. None of the allegations have been proven in court. The girl, identified in the lawsuit as having mental disabilities, cannot be identified because she is a minor. Her family is seeking $500,000 in damages. And from The Spectator, March the 3rd, for the first time in its 55-year history, the Hamilton Community Foundation is earmarking cash to battle a crippling economic downturn. As part of the foundation's ongoing anti-poverty war, some $1 million will go to charities and community groups for that purpose over the next 2 years. $150,000 will be made available as a stimulus package to help during the downturn. The foundation is hoping the $150,000 economic stimulus will help leverage additional investment from other sources. The HCF has announced that another $400,000 will address high-needs neighborhoods. From the National Post, Mounties warned of citizen videos. Just weeks before the tasering of Robert Szukanski was caught on a bystander's video and shown around the world, BCRCMP warned its officers that the availability of cheap cameras and sites such as YouTube could expose them to unprecedented public scrutiny. In addition, postings on outlets such as YouTube often quickly make it to standard news media outlets such as radio, television, and the print media. The report, completed in mid-September 2007, goes on to note that recordings of police operations could lead to increasingly more public exposure of RCMP member actions that some people may perceive to be inappropriate. 1 month after the report was written on October 14, 2007, Mr. Szukanski died at Vancouver International Airport. A video of the incident recorded by bystander Paul Pritchard later became public, sparking international media attention and public outrage. At the Braidwood inquiry, again by Petty Fong, Western Canada Bureau Chief at the Star. Man was down, but officer kept firing taser. Commission Counsel Art Vertlieb questioned how four officers wearing body armor, carrying handguns, and armed with pepper spray and collapsible batons could be frightened of Szukanski. Officer Millington, who fired the taser five times, stood up at one point during his testimony to demonstrate how the stapler had been held by Szukanski. He held the stapler at shoulder height with one hand, his other a clenched fist. Members of the public laughed at the sight, and retired Judge Thomas Braidwood had to request order. Millington admitted he made numerous errors in the statement he made within hours of the incident and subsequent statements to RCMP investigators. Video showed Szukanski did not come at the officers with the stapler and that he had fallen on the ground, his feet up, when Millington fired the second of five shots. This from the National Post. In the middle of February, prison watchdog decries level of violence in jails, lack of mental health services. Too many federal prisoners are dying or suffering preventable injuries behind bars, and measures taken by Correctional Service of Canada to address the problem have fallen short, Canada's prison watchdog says in his latest annual report. Howard Sapers, the Correctional Investigator of Canada, says the overall level of violence in penitentiaries is unacceptable. He calls for additional mental health services for prisoners and says the Correctional Service should make it a priority to train staff in how to deal with mentally ill offenders. The report says that although mental health problems are up to three times more common among inmates in correctional institutions than among the general Canadian population, there are major problems in providing services. The report makes clear the continuing difficulties can at all be blamed on a lack of money. That from CanWest News Service, February 14th. And wrapping up, to do with Afghanistan disabilities and military retirement, Canada's military retirees forced to wait to receive pension benefits, by Alan Woods from the Toronto Star. I found this, however, in the Spectator. A backlog in retirement paperwork prompted the Department of National Defense last fall to increase the average delay for members to receive pension checks up to 12 weeks from the normal 4 to 6 weeks. But even that three-month deadline seems like a best-case scenario for Master Corporal Rial Giroux, a married 44-year-old father of two teenage boys. His 12 weeks came due on February 13th, and he must now wait until the end of March for the $5,000 he is owed, calculated at $1,800 a month before taxes. He's in his 16th week of retirement and the bills are mounting. He's used up $7,000 from a line of credit at the bank. He owes $2,000 on his credit card and the interest is growing. I'm sure they're working on it, but that's not good enough sometimes, he told the Toronto Star from CFB Kingston, where he's employed part-time as a Canadian Forces reservist. They should be a little proactive and see things coming and say, all right, let's have certain contingencies in place to deal with the accrued number of people leaving. And that's it for the news this week. Stick with us. Professor Longhair wants to tell us about red beans.
Thank you. that's my red meat is cooking. When they get done, I'm gonna give you some. Now I'm going down in Louisiana, gonna find me a ham bone boy. I'm going down in Louisiana, gonna find me a ham. Jumping for joy.